Hey everybody, welcome to Season 2, Episode 7 of CreateCast. I'm your host, Chase Kay. Today we have an incredible guest. In addition to being my high school history teacher, this is also one of my favorite people of all time. We have Dr. Fiona Halloran. She is a historian, an author, and just an all-around super cool person, and this is a really fun interview. She was out here in California, so we had time to sit down for a quick interview. We talk sort of just about being a historian in general, what that means, her work as an author, her work as a teacher, and specifically we talk about her book, which is all around Thomas Nast, who, if you don't know Thomas Nast, he's sort of responsible for a lot of the traditional cartoon images that many of us grew up with, you know, whether that's sort of standard political cartoon figures or even sort of our modern depiction of Santa Claus. So even if you don't know the name, I'm sure that you have seen his art. So really cool book, awesome conversation, excited for you to hear it. If you haven't already, make sure you visit us at createcastpod.com where you can sign up for our email newsletter, see some behind the scenes stuff, or, you know, just drop us a line, let us know how we're doing. Also, make sure you visit us in the iTunes store. Just go into iTunes, search CreateCast, or, you know, whatever device you're on, your little iPhone, just go on, search CreateCast, and make sure you leave us a review, you know, give us a star rating. It really is the number one way that you can help support the show. So, really fun interview this week. Huge thanks to Dr. H for coming on the show. So, without any further ado, here's our episode with Fiona Halloran. Hey everybody, welcome to CreateCast. We're sitting here with Dr. Fiona Halloran, a historian, teacher, author, and one of the coolest people in the world. Thanks for coming on the show.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
So I want to obviously talk about your book, but I also want to talk about just how did you get into history? Because I think it's something that you know, okay, there are historians, but I think it's also rare that you meet someone who is a historian. Or at least, I think for the majority of people, it's sort of rare. Like, you maybe have a history teacher, but really, I mean, a historian who's a professional historian, that's something that's not all that common.
Well, I think most people have probably met and talked to professional historians without thinking about it. That is, if you've been to a national park, most of the park rangers are historians, trained in graduate school as historians. That's one reason why they're so good at interpreting some of the things that have happened and exhibits or sites within national parks. If you've been to a museum, you may have spoken to a historian. Especially museums like the Holocaust Museum that have research centers are often places where there are lots of young historians and historians engaged in research who are all around and who may be engaged in some of the public outreach. But of course, most people have taken a class in history either at the high school level or frequently in college during their general education requirements. And those are practiced, all of those people are practicing historians. It's just that it's common that you don't get a chance to talk to them about that facet of their work because professorial research is not something that comes up as much as it could in the classroom. So I think you probably have more contact with historians than you realize, and most people do, but the ins and outs of what historians do don't always make it to those interactions.
Well, and you're mentioning research centers, and I think people maybe have a good idea of sort of scientific research, but when historians do research, I mean, I assume that, you know, deals with, you know, trying to interpret documents, or some historians doing translations, right? I mean,
sometimes there's usually what you do is it's actually a lot like the scientific method. People, I think, underestimate how similar forms of inquiry can be. You start with a question, and your original question was, how did I come into history? And the truth is, I'm a lifer. I started reading biographies when I was in first grade and never stopped. That was my primary interest my entire life. But that's not true of all people who study history. Many of them come to the discipline through a question that they want to answer and they can't find an answer, or through a set of things that they observe that bother them. For instance, inequities in society that they want to know what the origin of, where the origins of those inequities lie, because they are so bothered by those inequities and want to make change. And they perceive that one of the routes to change is to understand the origins of the problem. So you start with a question, just as scientists do, and then you try to imagine how you would answer that question, just like scientists do. And so, for example, if you wanted to know, how did American slavery become so different from slavery around the world? Because slavery existed almost everywhere, and yet American slavery was very strange in that worldwide history of slavery because it was so focused on race And because it was so immutable, that is, to be a slave was an identity, not a status. And you could it was very difficult to move out of slavery into a life that resembled other people, which was not true of a lot of other forms of slavery in other parts of the world. And so if you were, for example, the Harvard historian Edmund Morgan, and you wanted to answer that question, you would set yourself a series of sub-questions in order to try to determine the answer to that larger question. Mm-hmm. And that's what he did in a very famous book called American Slavery, American Freedom, which when you read it, what you're seeing is a set of answers to a set of sub-questions. Did English settlers in the New World come over with an expected set of racial assumptions? Yes or no? If not, which is what he concludes, then how did they originally respond to the problem of labor? Okay, in this way. That's very different from what they had by the 18th century. How did it change? Okay, in this way. And so by answering this set of sub-questions, you eventually illuminate a reality that helps you to answer the bigger question. And historians who are engaged in research are looking for bits of evidence that will help them to answer either the big question or those sub-questions. And so when they're in the archives, so if you go to a place like the Huntington Library and Gardens here in Southern California, which most people go to because there's these beautiful gardens, there's also a building on that facility that's a library. And the historians are all in that library when they're not wandering around the garden talking to themselves, looking at documents. So you, as a historian, you figure out where there might be documents that would be useful to you, and then you go and you look at them and read through them page after page after page, looking for some clue that will help you to answer whatever question you're asking.
Yeah. And I assume, I mean, part of that process, it has to be difficult to not cherry pick.
Oh, yeah.
You know what you want. I mean, you're reading through it and you find, oh wow, this fits the, you know, maybe the, not the question, but maybe the answer that I'm looking for. So I mean, I assume that's a little bit difficult sometimes. It's just
it
making
is difficult.
Sure that you, and I don't know, maybe you go in with a certain set of assumptions and learn something that you didn't want to learn, or learn something that sort of upends your world, or upends someone who you've idolized, or some to a certain extent. I mean,
that's true, and that has been an ongoing discussion among historians. So, for example, the controversy around Thomas Jefferson, which isn't especially controversial anymore, but when I was an undergraduate, was really fierce, and about his relationship with his enslaved, it's hard to describe her, his partner in some ways, Sally Hemings. There have been a series of really spectacularly interesting, well-researched books about that. For me, Annette Gordon Reed's book is the best, and that's exactly what it is you take a puzzle. How do you understand a person who is all about liberty and at the same time who owns slaves and who does some terrible things, and reconcile those two facets of that person as a lived human being and also as a historical reputation? And so, yeah, you sometimes encounter things that you don't know what to do with. You sometimes encounter things which challenge what you had hoped to find. The worst thing, which happens to everyone all the time, is you encounter nothing. You go looking for a particular thing and it just
isn't there.
Or it's like finding a needle in a stack of needles. You find tiny, tiny glimpses of it, and it's so difficult to figure it out. And sometimes you can triumph over that with creative interpretation or with reading between the lines. And other times, you just can't, and you have to leave something mysterious.
You know, and that sort of makes me wonder also about, you know, maybe you're looking for something that, I mean, oftentimes throughout history, you know, disenfranchised peoples didn't really have the ability or the resources to keep good records.
Oh, yeah.
So it's, I mean, trying to look for things like that, it just reminds me. So tell me about Thomas Nast and why that figure sort of interested you, and what made you want to focus on him?
Well, so my book is the book version of my dissertation, and I chose it as a dissertation topic as a second choice. I had a first choice, which emerged from my undergraduate thesis, and that I was interested in the lives of women in the 1850s and 60s in Utah. I am not a member of the Church of Latter-day Saints, but these are Mormon women who had an enormous amount of religious freedom and authority. They could prophesy, they could lay on hands, all these things. And over time, that authority was withdrawn from them. And I was very interested in that and wanted to write about that. But there was really nobody appropriate to supervise that dissertation or who was enthusiastic about it. And in the course of my first couple years of my graduate education, I stumbled upon this man, Thomas Nast, whom everybody knows about because his cartoons are ubiquitous. But nobody knows anything about him. So if you say his name, any American historian is going to be familiar with it. But very few of them could have told you very much about him because the last biography of him had been written in 1904, 2 years after his death. And so what happened was that I was asked to write an encyclopedia entry about him for an encyclopedia my advisor was editing. And when I went to find materials, I couldn't. And I said to her, I'm a loser. I am a terrible graduate student. My research skills are awful. And she said, well, you know, let me call you back. And she went looking for materials. And she called back and she said, well, the reason you're having so much trouble is there's really not very much about him. And so that seemed to me an opportunity to know more about somebody very interesting. Now, the problem that you identify, that people don't always leave behind good records, that was a unique challenge with him. First, because he was an immigrant, and his English was not, it was fluent, but he didn't like to write. And so there's not much in his hand. And then even more pressingly, because when he died penniless, and his family auctioned his goods. They had to. And so many of his belongings and papers and the other relics of his life were scattered all over the country. And I'm sure there are many that are just somewhere in somebody's attic and nobody knows. And so that posed a real research challenge.
Well, I guess, you know, it's sort of interesting. Talk to me a little bit just about him as a person. Why did he end up dying penniless? You think of this figure who's like you're saying, ubiquitous. I mean, his drawings are so iconic. From Santa Claus to, why would a figure like that have died penniless?
Well, the thing about history, as you know, is that history will break your heart. It tears down all your heroes, and it shows you the frailty of the human condition at every turn. There's nothing terrible that people won't do. And in some cases, the heartbreaking element of it is that a person who is a perfectly good person can have what on its surface appears to be a wonderful life, and then everything falls apart. And that's essentially what happened to Thomas Nast. So in the early 1870s, Thomas Nast was a power in the land and rich. He had not only managed to finagle an excellent contract out of his newspaper, Harper's Weekly, for $5,000 a year, in exchange for which he provided them with cartoons on his own schedule, so essentially when he felt like it, which was a lot. I mean, he was very prolific, but he didn't have a set required thing. Yeah. He could send them 10 cartoons a week or one. And so he had $5,000 a year right there, which was quite a lot of money in 1871 and 72. But then on top of that, this man, James Redpath, who was sort of an impresario, talked Nast into going on a lecture circuit. And in the later part of the 19th century, Americans did not, of course, have television. And they loved to be entertained by going to hear people give lectures. This was their favorite thing. You would go to a church or a local hall, and this person would speak, and you would buy the tickets. Tickets might be 25 cents. They might be $5, depending on who it was. And some people made enormous amounts of money. Mark Twain, of course, was wonderful at this. And Thomas Nast was recruited by James Redpath, who had an agency where he represented speakers. And they sent him around, Thomas Nast around, giving these lectures, and he made tens of thousands of dollars. It was ridiculous. He made so much money. So but in the mid-70s, you would have thought that this was a man who was set for life. Unfortunately, he had several setbacks. One was that he invested a lot of money in a New York firm called Grant & Ward, which was U.S. Grant's son and another man, that's Ward. And Ward turned out to be a crook. And he ran away with all the money and bankrupted Thomas Nast, bankrupted U.S. Grant, just ruined a lot of people's lives. After that, and that was in the early 80s, Nast's relationship with Harper's Weekly fell apart. And in the later part of the 1880s, he stopped working for them. And he was unable to build a career by himself. That's what he wanted to do, but he didn't succeed. He then invested some money in a silver mine in Colorado, which turned out also to be either a bust or a scam. It's not entirely clear. And so by the 1890s, he was in really rough shape. And he had been an early supporter, in a small way, of Theodore Roosevelt. And so when Theodore Roosevelt became president, Nast wrote to him and asked for a diplomatic appointment. And it was very common in the late 19th century to give minor diplomatic posts to people who needed money and who were sort of national treasures. Bret Hart, for example, the writer, wasn't great at making money, and he got one. And so Nast hoped that they would just put him in some little consulship somewhere, and he could take the money, and it would be okay. And that's what they did, but the problem was the consulship was in Guayaquil, Ecuador, and Nast got sick and died very quickly, which was common there. It was a very unhealthy place at the time.
That's just amazing. I mean, it's just so astounding. I mean, I think people hear about stories like that. It's like, oh, well, it doesn't happen to anyone, but I mean, then it does, and it's just terrible. I mean, wow, that's incredible. So, obviously, when you started that encyclopedia entry, you were having a lot of trouble finding materials. How did you go about sort of uncovering things for this book and for your dissertation?
One of the things about historical research is that historical documents exist in a lot of places, and not all of those places are as organized as they could be. And so it's a kind of a fun treasure hunting activity. It's frustrating in the sense that you often feel that there is some secret out there and you can't find it. And on the other hand, it's exciting in that you might go someplace where you think, oh, one or two things, and find that they have amazing things because they don't really think it's very important, and they've never had the staff to write it all down. So I started with what I knew, which was that there were some documents at the Huntington Library and some documents at New York Public Library, and I went to those two places and read through everything they had. And then from there, I started going to smaller places, and one of the most wonderful places I went was the Rutherford B. Hayes Presidential Library and Center, which is in Fremont, Ohio. And they were extremely generous with their materials. They literally just brought me everything they had and plopped it down on a table and said, okay, see you. Let us know if you need anything. Yeah. But they also had all kinds of wonderful things that I didn't even know existed, like a little tiny black notebook, the kind that men used to carry in their back pocket, literally their little black book. And Nast had written all these things in it in 1860 and 61, including his dates with the woman who had become his wife and how he took her to church and how he wrote her a letter and how he was hoping to see her, which is adorable. And how much money he had and how much money he spent, because he never had enough money. So he was very concerned about that. And so there are lots of things that you just stumble upon. And one of the challenges of the work is to figure out how to use them. So it doesn't necessarily fit into your argument, and yet it's so delicious, you can't possibly let it go. So it's like being a treasure hunter.
So I'm curious, I mean, if I were going through this process, writing a biography or trying to tell someone's story, especially someone who is now deceased, long deceased, I would be so scared about misrepresenting that person and not really, because I think about, if somebody were to write the story of my life, just using sort of the remnants, any documents, anything I've written or anything. Let's even look, modern times, even with social media, I would be so, I don't know. I mean, I wonder if it would really capture who I am. Mm-hmm. And so is that a concern? And how do you maybe know that you've captured a person, and to what extent do you not know?
Oh, I think you don't know. And I certainly feel, I think any biographer would feel, a responsibility to that person and to that person's legacy. And in the Thomas Nast circumstance, I'm super proud of the fact that there is now a book about him. Mm. And I hope that most of the things I've had to say are reasonably accurate, because I think he deserves to have a lot of information available so that people who are interested in him can find out more about him. But yes, you worry all the time about it. And when you have unanswered questions, part of the problem with that is that you feel that you have an obligation to this person to do the right thing, and yet you can't answer this question about what did they really think and what did they mean to do, and were they forced into this position or did they take it willingly? And in Nast's case, he was at the height of his fame during Reconstruction. And so when you look at his cartoons, there are both cartoons which portray Black Americans in an incredibly unflattering light as inept citizens who are analogous to Irish immigrants, the people he despised the most and who he treated very, very badly in his cartoons. On the other hand, he drew cartoons in which Black Americans were the ultimate symbol of democratic citizenship, and they had suffered for their right to the vote, and they were heroes of the war. And so, yes, I would love to know, how do you reconcile those things? But he left behind so little in his own hand or even that reflected his ideas that that's an impossible question to answer. And I think in terms of our view of him, it's incredibly important. We want to know why he had that contradiction and what we should think of him in terms of something like race. And we just can't know that.
Yeah. Well, okay, this is just sort of a fun question, but I mean, I assume that you would love to be able to meet Thomas Nast. I mean, but who are some other figures that, I mean, you would just kill to meet? I mean, any figures who throughout history who you just really identify with or at least, I don't know, find something fascinating about that you would just love to spend an hour with talking?
Well, and the question, of course, is what do you want to do in your hour?
Yeah.
So, for example, from the time I was a little girl, I've been fascinated by Catherine de Medici and Queen Elizabeth I, and I'm just interested in those people. Sometimes the things I want to know about them are unknowable, even if, like, are you really going to go to Elizabeth I and say, but are you a virgin? Are you, though?
Yeah.
I mean, there's no way, right? In other cases, there are people who I think would be enjoyable to spend time with. So Thomas Nast, for example, was hilarious. He was great fun. One of the stories I told in the book was that one of his editors, later in his life, when he was in his late 40s or early 50s, one of the editors of Harper's Weekly came home, and this was a younger man. He had inherited the editorship from his, I think from his uncle. And he had a brownstone in New York, and he comes home, and he walks in the front door. And you know how brownstones have multiple levels, mm-hmm. right? And the entry hall is not where the bedrooms are. He walks in, and he hears feet pounding above his head on the upstairs level, and he says to the housekeeper, "What is that?" And she says, "Oh, well, Mr. Nast came by to see you, but since you weren't here, he's upstairs playing chase with the kids." I mean, he's just a really fun
That's
man,
amazing.
Right? So in terms of people you'd enjoy spending time with, I think he's great fun. I think I would love to spend time with someone like the food writer M.F.K. Fisher, who was wicked and witty and had very firm opinions and seems as though she would be someone who it would be interesting to spend an hour with. So there are people, you want to start by asking yourself, am I trying to get an answer to an unanswered question? Or am I trying to just enjoy myself? I would love to spend an hour telling John Adams that he is great and that people are going to hate him for 200 years, but that really there's a core of us who think he's amazing. I don't know that he would be happy to hear that, though.
And well, this has been a really fun conversation, and I appreciate you taking the time.
It was my pleasure.
As always, a huge thanks to our guests for coming on the show. Dr. H is awesome, and I was really, really happy to get her on the podcast. As always, make sure you visit us at createcastpod.com or drop us a line in the iTunes store. Just search CreateCast, help us out, helps other people find the show, and it is the best way that you can help support. If you want to check out Dr. H's book, I'm going to be linking that in the show description, so check those out. And until next time, here's one final word from Dr. H.
Hi, this is Fiona Halloran, reminding you to make good.